Chapter 5. The Hammer and the Rock. Perhaps the 6th of April, 1989, will go down in history as the first designer drug raid. As heavily armed and flak-jacketed SWAT commandos stormed the alleged Rock House near 51st and Main Street in South Central LA, Nancy Reagan and Los Angeles Police Chief Daryl Gates sat across the street, nibbling fruit salad in a luxury motorhome emblazoned The Establishment. According to the Times, the former First Lady could be seen freshening her makeup while the SWATs roughly frisked and cuffed the 14 narco-terrorists captured inside the small stucco bungalow. As hundreds of incredulous neighbors, "Hey, Nancy Reagan, she's over here in the ghetto," gathered behind police barriers, the great naysayer, accompanied by Chief Gates and a small army of nervous Secret Service agents, toured the enemy fortress, with its occupants still bound on the floor in flabbergasted submission. After frowning at the tawdry wallpaper and drug-bust debris, Nancy, who looked fetching in her LAPD windbreaker, managed to delve instantly into the dark hearts at her feet and declare, "These people in here are beyond the point of teaching and rehabilitating." This was music to the ears of the chief, whose occupation thrives on incorrigibility. Gates fairly beamed as television cameras pressed in. "We thought she had to see it for herself, and she did. She is a very courageous woman." It was a heck of a heavy date, even if Nancy's press secretary, Mark Weinberg, complained obnoxiously the next day about the media's failure to take better advantage of the photo opportunity. In the larger picture, however, Nancy Reagan, who had lived in Southern California for nearly 50 years, had made her first visit to the ghetto, and Chief Gates, who dreams of becoming governor, had his perfect drug bust. It was an easy victory in a drug war that the LAPD secretly loves losing. Vietnam here. "Tonight we pick 'em up for anything and everything," LAPD spokesman, 9th of April, 1988. Flashback to the previous April. 1,000 extra duty patrolmen, backed by elite tactical squads and a special anti-gang task force, bring down the first act of Operation Hammer upon 10 square miles of South Central Los Angeles, between Exposition Park and North Long Beach, arresting more black youth than at any time since the Watts Rebellion of 1965. Like a Vietnam-era search-and-destroy mission, and many senior police are proud Vietnam veterans, Chief Gates saturates the street with his blue machine, jacking up thousands of local teenagers at random, like so many surprised peasants. Kids are humiliatingly forced to kiss the sidewalk or spread eagle against police cruisers, while officers check their names against computerized files of gang members. There are 1,453 arrests. The kids are processed in mobile booking centers, mostly for trivial offenses like delinquent parking tickets or curfew violations. Hundreds more uncharged have their names and addresses entered into the electronic gang roster for future surveillance. Gates, who earlier in the year had urged the invasion of Colombia, in 1980 he offered Jimmy Carter the LAPD SWAT team to liberate the hostages in Tehran, derided civil libertarian protests. "This is war. We're exceedingly angry. We want to get the message out to the cowards out there, and that's what they are, rotten little cowards. We want the message to go out that we're going to come and get 'em." To reinforce the metaphor, but meaning it literally, the chief of the DA's hardcore drug unit added, "This is Vietnam here." The them, what a local mayor calls the Viet Cong abroad in our society, are the members of local black gangs, segmented into several hundred fighting sets while loosely aligned with two hostile super gangs, the Crips and the Bloods, universally distinguished, as every viewer of Dennis Hopper's Colors now knows, by their color coding of shoelaces, t-shirts, and bandanas, red for Bloods, blue for Crips. In the official version, which Hollywood is incessantly reheating and further sensationalizing, these gangs comprise veritable urban guerrilla armies organized for the sale of crack and outgunning the police with huge arsenals of Uzi and MAC-10 automatics. Although gang cohorts are typically hardly more than high school sophomores, Local politicians frequently compare them to the murderous militias of Beirut. Across town, or increasingly in South Central itself, there is another large traditional constituency of Latino gang membership, frequently depicted in the same lurid images. Indeed, the primary focus of gang hysteria in the 1970s was the rising violence amongst the third generation of East LA Batos Locos. But a major community counteroffensive, unabetted by the police and led instead by priests, parents, and gang veteranos, appealing to Chicano unity, managed to dramatically reduce Eastside gang killings from 24 in 1978 to 0 in 1988. A major recrudescence of Latino gang warfare in recent days may be directly attributable to new liaisons with the crack trade. If anything made ghetto turf rivalries so much more deadly than the East Sides during the 1980s, it was the incomparably higher economic stakes involved in control of the retail cocaine trade. Gangbanging rose in a murderous arc from 1984 in rough synchronization with the emergence of crack as the narcotic equivalent of fast food, and the rerouting of the main cocaine trail from Florida to Southern California via Mexico. Since the beginning of 1987, gang-related slayings, principally in Southside city and county areas, have averaged over one per day. This very real epidemic of youth violence, with its deep roots, as we shall see, in exploding youth poverty, has been inflated by law enforcement agencies and the media into something quite phantasmagoric. In a numbers game that ceases to distinguish the authentic high rollers and stone killers of the gang world from the claimers and wannabes, the city attorney's office has steadily escalated its estimates of hardcore gang membership from 10,000 to 50,000. Local media have amplified this figure to 70,000 to 80,000, while sheriff's gang experts have invoked the specter of 100,000 rotten little cowards overrunning Los Angeles County. Meanwhile, an Andromeda strain of Crips and Bloods is reported to have inflicted the entire West, from Tucson to Anchorage, before invading Middle America itself, with new sightings from Kansas City to Buffalo. Like the tramp scares in the 19th century, or the Red Scares in the 20th, the contemporary gang scare has become an imaginary class relationship, a terrain of pseudo-knowledge and fantasy projection. But as long as the actual violence was more or less confined to the ghetto, the gang wars were also a voyeuristic titillation to white suburbanites devouring lurid imagery in their newspapers or on television. Then, in December 1987, frisson became fear, as Southside gang hitmen mistakenly gunned down a young woman outside a theater in the posh Westwood Village Entertainment District near UCLA. Westwood's influential merchants, who had recently induced the LAPD to enforce curfew ordinances to repel non-white youth from the village, clamored for extra police protection, while local council member Zev Yaroslavsky, then essaying a cock-like challenge to Mayor Bradley, posted a huge reward for apprehension of the urban terrorists. The dramatically different press coverage of, and preferential police response to, the Westwood shooting ignited the simmering resentment of black community leaders, who blasted Yaroslavsky, Bradley, and the LAPD for failing to respond comparably to the mayhem in their neighborhoods. For several weeks, the council chambers resounded to an arcane debate over relative police response times in different divisions and the comparative allocations of department personnel. This ideologically circumscribed and loaded debate, focusing exclusively on the demand for a more equal and vigorous prosecution of the war against gangs, was a cue for the ambitious and media-hungry chief to reclaim center stage. Gangbusters. This is the era of the police. If I were chief, I'd ask for as many as I could. Councilmember Richard Alatorre. Since the days of the legendary Chief William Parker in the early 1950s, the LAPD has been regarded by LA's black community as a redneck army of occupation. On the eve of Daryl Gates' appointment as chief in 1978, the so-called Masked Marvel, a white ex-cop who had served 5 years in 77th Street's Fort Apache, appeared in disguise on a series of local television shows to luridly chronicle the pathological racism and trigger happiness of the Blue Knights towards ordinary blacks. Gates, the third Parker protege in a row to command the LAPD, ridiculed these charges and the liberals who listened to them. Soon afterwards came the police killing of Eula Love, a 39-year-old black widow in default of her gas bill. Community outrage was so great that Watts Assemblymember Maxine Waters demanded, "Chief Gates, we want you out." As Gates defended the 12 38 caliber holes in Mrs. Love's body before a cowed police commission, several hundred black clergy members petitioned the Carter administration to intervene. They asked the Justice Department to probe a pattern of systematic abuse of non-whites, including more than 300 police shootings of minority citizens in the last decade. Meanwhile, the Coalition Against Police Abuse, CAPA, collected tens of thousands of signatures calling for the establishment of a civilian police review board. The LAPD rode out this storm in alliance with a silent Mayor Bradley, whose gubernatorial ambitions seemed to preclude any stance that could be interpreted by white voters as anti-police. Thus insulated from political accountability, Chief Gates was only emboldened to taunt the black community with increasingly contemptuous or absurd excuses for police brutality. In 1982, for example, following a rash of LAPD chokehold killings of young black men in custody, he advanced the extraordinary theory that the deaths were the fault of the victim's racial anatomy, not excessive police force. "We may be finding that in some blacks, when the carotid chokehold is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do on normal people." By 1987, however, after the crack blizzard had hit South Central in full force, some black leaders began to weigh police misconduct as a lesser evil compared to drug-dealing gangs. Groups like the Urban League and SCLC redefined the community's problem as too little policing instead of too much, and repudiated attempts to restrain the LAPD. The equal policing furor after the Westwood shooting gave Gates an unexpected opportunity to convert some of these former critics into born-again fans of his aggressive policing. While politicians merely worked their jaws, he was seen to respond dramatically to South Central's urgent outcry for police protection. With a typical eye for media exposure, the chief launched the first of his heavily hyped anti-gang sweeps. The LAPD already conducted regular sweeps to drive homeless people off the streets of downtown. This so-called gang-related active trafficker suppression program, GROTS, targeted drug neighborhoods for raids by 200 to 300 police under orders to stop and interrogate anyone who they suspect is a gang member, basing their assumptions on their dress or their use of gang hand signals. Thus, on the flimsy probable cause of red shoelaces or high-five handshakes, the task forces in February and March mounted 9 sweeps, impounded 500 cars, and made nearly 1,500 arrests. By Good Friday, Gates was gloating over the success of Gratz in drastically curtailing street violence. A few hours after his self-congratulatory speech, however, some rogue Crips mowed down a crowd on a South Central street corner, killing a 19-year-old woman. Hysteria again took command in the Civic Center. County Supervisor Kenneth Hahn called for the mobilization of the National Guard, while Yaroslavsky claimed that the city was fighting a war on gang violence that's worse than Beirut. Gates, frantic to keep the LAPD in command of events, announced that the full manpower reserves of the department would be thrown into the super sweeps called the Hammer. Although one high-ranking LAPD veteran would later admit that the catch-as-catch-can strategy was just a hokey publicity deal, it was billed as LA Law Enforcement's D-Day. And like the Marines hitting the beach at Da Nang and the beginning of LBJ's escalations in Vietnam, the first of the 1,000 cop blitzkriegs made the war in South Central LA look deceptively easy. Black politicians generally applauded Gates, even if that put some civil rights leaders in the awkward position of undermining the civil rights of black youth. But as State Senator Diane Watson's press secretary rationalized it, when you have a state of war, civil rights are suspended for the duration of the conflict. The local peasantry, on the other hand, were wary and even belligerent. As an LAPD spokesperson complained, people in the neighborhood, instead of being on our side, make all kinds of accusations. Indeed, the NAACP reported an unprecedented number of complaints, in the hundreds, about unlawful police conduct. Community members also claimed that the police were deliberately fueling gang violence by leaving suspects on enemy turfs, writing over Crip graffiti with blood colors or vice versa, and spreading incendiary rumors. Given an open season to terrorize gang members and crack dealers, the LAPD predictably began to exceed the call of duty. On the 5th of April, they shot down an unarmed teenager cowering behind a small palm tree on Adams Boulevard. He was alleged to be reaching suspiciously into his pants. More importantly, he was a suspected gang member, a category that now seemed to justify abuse or even execution. A few weeks later, Hammer forces, storming one of the nearly 500 rock houses that they claimed to have put out of business in 1988, poured double-aught buckshot into an 81-year-old retired construction worker. No drugs were actually found. There was a strong suspicion that the police had an incorrect address, and the victim's niece, a witness, testified that he was killed with his hands held up. The LAPD merely replied that gangs were now paying off elderly people to use their homes as sales points. No disciplinary action was taken. In a year when every gang murder had become a headline atrocity, these two police homicides caused barely a blip. With most of the black political family arrayed behind the LAPD, civil libertarians spoke in tiny voices. Looking back on the beginning of the Hammer, journalist Joe Dominic would later ask, "Where was LA's liberal community? A community that boasts the largest American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, chapter in the nation." In fact, the Southern California chapter of the ACLU, an organization that in past decades had been frequently spied on and victimized by the LAPD, did condemn the Hammer. ACLU attorney Joan Howarth, who specializes in defending youth civil liberties, an endangered species, was eloquent in exposing the hypocrisy of Chief Gates's Rambo-style gimmicks. But Howarth was soon transferred to other responsibilities, while the ACLU shifted the bulk of its energies to confront the Right to Life movement. Meanwhile, another group of prominent liberal attorneys, who had been carefully preparing a class action suit against the police based on affidavits taken from victims of the Hammer, suddenly dropped the project. It was later revealed that they had been hectored and even red-baited by one of the city's most notable civil rights leaders, now a crusader for police saturation of the streets. With legal opposition thus chilled out, the gangbusters had little reason to look over their shoulders as they started ronsoning hooches and boosting body counts in the rice paddies of South Central. The raid on Dalton Street in August 1988, if not quite the melee of the war against the underclass, an infamy that better attaches to the 1985 MOVE Holocaust in Philadelphia so much admired by Chief Gates, was nonetheless a grim portent of what unleashing the police really means. A company-sized detachment of 88 police from the Southwest Division, an outpost racked internally by charges of racial abuse against black officers, swooped down on a group of apartments in the 3900 block of Dalton Avenue, near Exposition Park, and not far from the infamous Black Dahlia murder site of 1946. Wielding shotguns and sledgehammers, as well as racist epithets and a search warrant, the assault force, as Chief Gates would later admit, got out of hand. Residents said they were punched and kicked by officers during what those arrested called an orgy of violence. Residents reported the officers spray-painted walls with slogans such as LAPD rules. They also accused the officers of throwing washing machines into bathtubs, pouring bleach over clothes, smashing walls and furniture with sledgehammers and axes, and ripping an outside stairwell away from one building. Damage to the apartments was so extensive that the Red Cross offered disaster assistance and temporary shelter to displaced residents, a service normally provided in the wake of major fires, floods, earthquakes, or other natural disasters. At Southwest Division, the 32 terrified captives of the raid were forced to whistle the theme from the 1960s Andy Griffith TV show, apparently the Horst Wessel song of the LAPD, while they ran a gauntlet of cops beating them with fists and long steel flashlights. At least they did not have to meet Nancy Reagan. When it was all over, lives and homes were devastated, and the LAPD had 2 minor drug arrests. Despite allegations in the search warrant, the police found neither wanted gang members nor weapons, just a small quantity of dope belonging to 2 non-resident teenagers. Moreover, for the first time in memory, the LAPD blew the cover up. The cyclone-like destruction of Dalton Street was too extreme to tally with initial police accounts of the incident. The many victims all told the same horror story, and the Dalton raiders stumbled over their alibi that the damage had been gang-inflicted. With its dirty linen waving in the breeze, and the FBI investigating possible civil rights violations, the LAPD initiated disciplinary or criminal action against 38 officers. These included former Southwest Division Captain Thomas Elfmont, the Lieutenant Callie of this incident, who was accused of ordering his raiders to level and make uninhabitable the targeted apartments, and Sergeant Charles Spicer, who reiterated Elfmont's orders in the field. This is a Class A search. That means carpets up, drywall down. But physician, heal thyself is not Chief Gates's favorite motto. Within months of the Dalton Street raid, the chief was again blustering away in apparent defense of police brutality. After being called to testify in the case of the Lareses, a Chicano family beaten by other police raiders, he told reporters that Mr. Lares was lucky to have only his nose broken. The jurors in the Lares suit were so outraged by this remark that they raised the victim's damages by $200,000, which they ordered Gates to pay out of his own pocket, an unprecedented attempt to hold the chief liable for his incitements. At Mayor Bradley's urging, the city council paid the fine, as it will the $3 million in damages for the Dalton Street outrage. In the meantime, as the hammer mercilessly pounded away at South Central's mean streets, it became increasingly apparent that its principal catch consisted of drunks, delinquent motorists, and teenage curfew violators, offenders only by virtue of the selective application of curfews to non-Anglo neighborhoods. By 1990, the combined forces of the LAPD and the sheriffs, implementing their own street saturation strategy, had picked up as many as 50,000 suspects. Even allowing for a percentage of Latino detainees, this remains an astonishing figure, considering there are only 100,000 black youths in Los Angeles. In some highly touted sweeps, moreover, as many as 90% of detained suspects have been released without charges, an innocent victim rate that belies LAPD demonology, as well as evoking an analogy with inflated VC body counts in Vietnam. As we saw in the last chapter, Chief Gates's response to the declining shock value of the hammer was to institutionalize the sweeps as semi-permanent community occupations, narcotic enforcement zones acting as the urban equivalents of strategic hamlets. Actually, what the chief really wanted was to intern gang members in abandoned military bases with landmines planted behind barbed wire fences. Claiming that the Pico Union neighborhood had become a veritable flea market for drug dealers, the chief ordered a 27-square-block area sealed off with barricades and police checkpoints in October 1989. The next month, while the Berlin Wall was being spontaneously dismantled, the LAPD extended the barricades, Operation Cul-de-Sac, to a barrio in the valley, and then to a huge stretch of Central Avenue in South Central. But the real bite in this new escalation came less from LAPD's visible barriers than from the invisible legal partitioning of the city, instigated by Los Angeles's aggressive young city attorney, James Hahn. Little Jimmy versus the Playboy Gangsters. The continued protection of gang activity under the guise of upholding our Constitution is causing a deadly blight on our city. City Attorney Hahn. Hahn is a strangely magical name in the flatlands of South Central Los Angeles. For nearly 40 years, Kenneth Hahn, a white Democrat, has been one of the 5 little kings on the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, thanks to his impregnable support from black voters. In return, Supervisor Hahn, who has more personally disposable power than any of Los Angeles's black politicians, including Mayor Bradley, has engraved his name across a series of showpiece government projects in the ghetto, ranging from a fortress shopping mall in Willowbrook, described in the last chapter, to the new General Post Office on Central Avenue. He also receives a lion's share of credit for the integration of the county's 90,000-strong civil service, the major employer in otherwise deindustrialized black neighborhoods. Perpetually attuned to the complaints of his older, more conservative constituents, he has always been a hawk on the gang question. As far back as 1972, when the first sagging pants and blue bandanas announced the advent of Crippin' in ghetto high schools and playgrounds, Hahn was off the mark with a 48-point plan to quarantine juvenile terrorism. Indeed, he was one of the first politicians in the 1970s to apply that most loaded of terms to inner-city 13-year-olds. James Hahn is a chip off the old block who used his father's clout, including Southside patronage, to win the city attorneyship in a bloody battle with a Manet Phelps protege from the West Side, no mean feat, as we saw in Chapter 2. Like his predecessor, the current county district attorney, Ira Reiner, Hahn is an ambitious younger Democrat trying to turn the law and order tables on older Republicans like Chief Gates and ex-chief, now state senator Ed Davis, by being an even tougher cop in the courtroom. This is not to say that the younger Hahn is without liberal scruples. In fact, he has compiled an extraordinary record prosecuting slumlords and other vampires of the poor. But since the scalps of gang members, not slumlords, are the current wampum of political fortune, Hahn has determined to make Los Angeles the showpiece of an unprecedented attempt, since emulated nationally by drug czar Bennett and HUD Secretary Kemp, to criminalize gang members and their families as a class. If Chief Gates sometimes seems too much like a Barnum playing at Dragnet, with his trick bag of rock house raids and mega sweeps, Jim Hahn is, as they say on the street, serious as a heart attack. Liberal conscience aside, he has probably traveled further than any metropolitan law enforcement official in the country towards establishing the legal infrastructure of an American police state. Hahn ingeniously reworked his dad's old juvenile terrorism quarantine as the opening gambit of his own war on gangs. In the fall of 1987, he surprised the legal establishment by filing a civil lawsuit against the Playboy Gangster Crips, an unincorporated association. The Playboy Gangsters, one of the countless neighborhood isotopes of the Crip subculture, were singled out because of their unusual proximity in the 26-square-block Cadillac Corning area just south of Beverly Hills and east of Beverly Wood to rich white neighborhoods. An amalgam of gang members from several West Side high schools, Hamilton, University, and even Palisades, the Playboy Gangsters moved into the Cadillac Corning neighborhood around 1981. Originally peddling marijuana, they shifted into the more lucrative rock cocaine or crack trade, as it appeared in 1983-4. Because of its adjacency to the world of Rodeo Drive, Cadillac Corning is an ideal drive-in drug market, catering to rich white youth and giving the Playboy Gangsters an enviable locational advantage over other Southside gangs. No individual was specifically cited in Hahn's suit, only Does 1-300. The court was requested to issue a temporary restraining order with 24 separate provisions spelling out a range of activities that would become illegal. These included congregating in groups of two or more, remaining in public streets for more than 5 minutes at any time of day or night, and having visitors in their homes for less than 10 minutes, an allusion to drug sales. Hahn also demanded the banning of gang colors and the imposition of a dusk-to-dawn curfew for juvenile members. Finally, he asked for a pass law provision. Within the 26 square blocks of Cadillac Corning, any doe would be subject to arrest unless they could produce a signed letter from a lawful property owner or employer authorizing their presence. As the ACLU was not slow to point out, Hahn's inversion of the usual corporate immunity, that is, his demand for collective liability for gang offenses, mirrored the reasoning of the contemporary South African court that sentenced the Sharpeville Six to death for mere membership in a mob that lynched an informer. Joan Howarth icily observed that the city attorney's proposed remedies, a dress code, a curfew, contempt citations, and so on, were weak trade-offs for the suspension of the Constitution. Superior Court Judge Deering, hearing the case, agreed with the ACLU that abatement actions were only constitutional if applied against named and served individuals. Although Hahn was abraded in court, the debate continued in the pages of the Times. The ACLU's new chairperson, Danny Goldberg, stellar rock producer and leading Democratic fundraiser, accused fellow Democrat Hahn of being a headline hunter with simplistic solutions. The unabashed city attorney slashed back at the ACLU's silent surrender to misplaced notions about civil liberties of gang members in a city under siege. Maintaining that no constitutional rights are absolute, and evoking the precedent of war, Hahn virtually accused the ACLU of being responsible for the perpetuation of gang violence. Despite the setbacks in the Playboy gangster lawsuit, the city attorney's office redoubled its search for a means to outlaw gang membership. In November 1987, they dusted the cobwebs off California's 1919 Criminal Syndicalism Act to indict Michael Peanut Martin, an 18-year-old high school dropout alleged to be the ringleader of seven self-proclaimed working-class Aryan youth from the San Fernando Valley. This tiny skinhead malignancy, accused of harassing Latino immigrants, was obviously the legal in locum for gangs in general. The Criminal Syndicalism Act, enacted specifically to destroy the IWW and the fledgling Communist Party, is an ancient horror. Last utilized unsuccessfully against two organizers of the Maoist Progressive Labor Party in the 1960s, most reporters and civil libertarians were surprised that it still remained on the books, much less that any prosecutor would brashly attempt to resuscitate it. In the event, Hahn was predictably stymied by constitutional considerations and forced to reindict Martin under more prosaic misdemeanor statutes. Still, Hahn had made his point. He could now claim that he had exhausted available legal remedies and that only the legislature could rescue Los Angeles from the gang siege. His position was neatly echoed by his predecessor, County DA Ira Reiner, another candidate yearning for higher office. While at Hahn's post in 1982, Reiner had anticipated the principle of collective liability by getting the court to order gang members, whether or not they were individually responsible, to remove graffiti or face jail. Now, at a histrionic press conference, he announced that he was no longer concerned with the rehabilitation of street criminals, but only with putting every one of those little murderous hoodlums in jail for as long as possible. To achieve this objective, he promised that his office would abandon plea bargaining in gang-related cases and instead fight for maximum sentences regardless of extenuations. The objective is to use each occasion that a gang member is arrested for a crime, no matter how minor, as a means to remove them from the streets for as long as possible. Together with Hahn, he also called for decisive action in Sacramento. Governor Dukmejian's Special State Task Force on Gangs and Drugs attempted to oblige Hahn and Reiner by proposing legislation to try 16-year-olds as adults, impose life sentences in cases involving Uzis and other automatic weapons, and reopen vacant military bases as gang detention centers. State Attorney General John Vandekamp, another Los Angeles law and order liberal, called for massively augmented state aid for Los Angeles's gangbusters, as well as an 8,000-capacity prison for gang offenders in the Mojave Desert. He also brightened the day for a particular group of ethnic entrepreneurs by announcing that, compared to the Crips and Bloods, the Mafia have become the least of our problems. Meanwhile, Los Angeles's new FBI chief, Lawrence Lawler, taking over a scandal-ridden regional office, promised that street gangs would be his chief priority and hinted at new applications of the all-encompassing Federal Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO, which the feds had already invoked against L.A. Crip infiltrators in Seattle. But the new iron heel of the war against the gangs, crafted by Reiner's and Hahn's staffs, and co-sponsored by two L.A. Democrats, State Senator Alan Robbins from the Valley and Assemblywoman Gwen Moore from South Central, is a state-level son of RICO. although State Senator Bill Lockyer, Democrat Hayward, warned that the bill would have justified the internment of the Japanese in World War II, the Street Terrorism Enforcement and Prevention Act of 1988, STEP, was passed with frenetic bipartisan support from Southern California. In the spirit of the original Playboy gangster suit, STEP makes membership in a criminal gang a felony. The law allows prosecution of any person who actively participates in a criminal street gang with knowledge that its members have engaged in a pattern of criminal gang activity and who willfully promotes or assists any felonious conduct by members of that gang. In explaining the implementation of the law, Reiner noted that a gang member would now face 3 years in prison for loaning a car used in commission of a crime, even if he had not otherwise participated in the act. What Reiner did not emphasize was that the fine print of the law also provides for the prosecution of parents of gang members who do not exercise reasonable care to prevent their children's criminal activities. In the spring of 1989, year two of The Hammer, Hahn's office tested Stepp's bad parent provision with the sensationalized arrest of a 37-year-old South Central woman whose 15-year-old son had earlier been arraigned for participation in a gang rape. In an elaborately contrived exposé for the press, detectives and city attorneys feigned horror at discovering the Oedipal command post of the gang conspiracy. Authorities said they were stunned at the pervasive atmosphere of gang activity within the household. "It looks like the headquarters for the local gang," said Robert Ferber of the city attorney's gang unit. "There was graffiti all over the walls. I was amazed. I couldn't believe my own eyes," said Southwest LAPD Detective Roy Gonzake. "In all my 20 years on the police force, I've never seen anything like this. It was obvious that the mother was just as much a part of the problem because she condoned this activity." Unsurprisingly, anti-gang crusaders avidly latched onto this image of Mama Crip in order to vilify inner-city welfare queens, supposedly breeding a generation of baby street terrorists. But as Hahn's assistant, Robert Ferber, meditated on the severity of her penalty, "I certainly don't think she is the type of woman who will benefit from counseling," and Southwest Division Detective Commander Nick Bakai promised that he would keep arresting the parents of gang members, as many as necessary, the contrived portrait of maternal malevolence began to disintegrate. Instead of a gang mother, reporters discovered a hard-working single parent of three, coping as best she could with overwhelming problems. They also found that the police investigation into her background was hasty and error-ridden. In their race to apply STEP against ghetto parents, Hahn's office and the LAPD anti-gang unit had only managed to reenact the moral equivalent of the Dalton Street raid against an innocent woman. After smearing her name in the press for weeks, the STEP charges were quietly dropped. Although the ACLU temporarily re-entered the fray to denounce the use of headline justice to whitewash ineffective and constitutionally indefensible laws, City Attorney Hahn was undeterred. While STEP allowed his office to add centuries of additional jail time to sentences, new abatement laws, patterned after the 1912 Red Light Abatement Act, authorized the city attorney to drain cesspools of drug dealing by suing landlords, evicting tenants, and even bulldozing houses suspected of being drug nuisances. Operation Knockdown. Patterned after HUD Secretary Kemp's controversial national policy of expelling from public housing the families of those arrested, not necessarily convicted, for drug dealing, these new abatement regulations, acting in concert with STEP and barricaded narcotics enforcement zones, imply a West Bank strategy towards the troubled neighborhoods of South Central LA. The terrorism metaphor has metastasized as Hahn and Reiner have criminalized successive strata of the community. Gang members, then gang parents, followed by whole gang families, gang neighborhoods, and perhaps even a gang generation. A generation under curfew. "I think people believe that the only strategy we have is to put a lot of police officers on the streets and harass people and make arrests for inconsequential kinds of things." "Well, that's part of the strategy, no question about it." Chief Gates. As a result of the war on drugs, Every non-Anglo teenager in Southern California is now a prisoner of gang paranoia and associated demonology. Vast stretches of the region's sumptuous playgrounds, beaches, and entertainment centers have become virtual no-go areas for young blacks or Chicanos. After the Westwood gang shooting, for example, Don Jackson, an off-duty black policeman from Hawthorne, precisely in order to make a point about de facto apartheid, led some ghetto kids into the village. They carefully observed the law, yet predictably they were stopped, forced to kiss concrete, and searched. Jackson, despite police identification, was arrested for disturbing the peace. Afterwards, at a press conference, Chief Gates excoriated him for provocations and a cheap publicity stunt, descriptions more aptly applied to the LAPD. Similarly, a few weeks later, a busload of well-dressed black members of Youth for Christ were humiliatingly surrounded by security guards and frisked for drugs and weapons at the popular Magic Mountain amusement park. Park managers adamantly defended their right to search suspicious, i.e. black, youth, as a matter of policy. More recently, 24 black and Latino kids out to play baseball at Will Rogers State Park were arrested for violating some white cop's personal Jim Crow law. The Times reported the kids' account of how they spent 90 terrifying minutes held face down on the polo field while a group of LAPD taunted and brutalized them. One officer was quoted as having told them that the scenic park in Pacific Palisades was for rich white people only. The NAACP and the Mexican American Political Association have jointly filed suit against the LAPD for this incident. As we saw in the last chapter, curfews have become essential weapons in the LAPD's campaign against the subversive crowd. Residential curfews are deployed selectively and almost exclusively against black and Chicano neighborhoods. As a consequence, thousands of youth in South Central acquire minor records for behavior that would be illegal or inoffensive on the West Side. During daylight hours, moreover, the post-Byrd California Supreme Court has given police carte blanche to stop and search any youthful person for suspicion of truancy. As with the random drunk driver checkpoints that the Lucas Court has also authorized, or the random car weapons searches that the legislature has enacted as part of anti-gang legislation, the probable cause safeguard against capricious stop and search is rendered practically extinct. Police now have virtually unlimited discretion, day or night, to target undesirables, especially youth. One of the most disturbing instances of such police targeting has been the LAPD Ramparts Division's relentless campaign against Salvadorian youth in the MacArthur Park District, just west of downtown. Community workers in this poor and overcrowded neighborhood, the home of tens of thousands of refugees from U.S.-financed state terrorism in Central America, tell bitter tales of police brutality. Ramparts cops were particularly incensed by church efforts to work with members of Mara Salvatrucha, MS, liberally translated, cool Salvadorian dudes, but also known as crazy riders, a vast, loosely organized gang grouping. When the Joffrey Ballet in 1988 offered some free seats to Salvadorian youngsters studying dance at a local church center, Ramparts Division warned the ballet that the kids were the most ruthlessly violent in the city and that the church was basically a gang hangout. The terrified ballet withdrew the tickets. Meanwhile, coincident with the hammer sweeps in South Central, the LAPD's CRASH, Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, program, launched a new offensive to decimate the leadership of MS. Howard Azell, Western Regional Commissioner for the INS, whom we shall meet again in the next chapter, assigned 8 teams of federal immigration agents to work with the LAPD, identifying and deporting gang members. As the leader of the INS agents explained, gang membership, not necessarily criminal activity, was the qualification for deportation. If a gang member is out on the street and the police can't make a charge, we will go out and deport them for being here illegally, if they fit that criterion. 56 of the 175 youth deported were returned to El Salvador, to uncertain fates at the hands of the military and death squads. But the growing authoritarian reach of police control is nowhere as disturbingly evident as in Los Angeles schools. Another of Chief Gates's publicity-generating body count projects is the so-called school buy program. As ACLU attorney Joan Howarth describes it, up to high school, kids are taught to look on cops as friends. After the eighth grade, school buy cops are trying to entrap them into drug deals. Youthful undercover cops, in fact, infiltrate high schools, enticing students to sell them drugs. Howarth particularly denounces the exploitation of peer pressure to create narcotic offenses. In many cases, the undercover police, male and female, exploit sexuality and attractiveness. For this reason, special education, educationally handicapped students, approached for possibly the first time in their life by an attractive member of the opposite sex, are especially likely to become entrapped. The program is a complete fraud. With little impact on the actual volume of drug sales and negligible success in capturing adult suppliers, the school buy program is primarily a cheap source of the felony arrests that make the chief look heroic in the media. Thanks partially to such police vigilance, juvenile crime in Los Angeles County is increasing at 12% annually. 1 out of 12 kids in Los Angeles aged 11 to 17 will be arrested, half for serious felonies. For older juveniles tried as adults, moreover, conviction rates have soared ominously over the last decade as prosecutors routinely overcharge suspects, threatening them with long sentences in order to force them to cop pleas to lesser charges. Public defenders and civil libertarians alike have denounced this practice of railroading thousands of poor and frightened teenagers into undeserved criminal convictions. At the same time, the new punitive increments that STEP and federal and state anti-drug laws have added to sentencing expose a terrible class and racial bias. As the Times points out, under new federal statutes, defendants convicted of selling 5 grams or more of crack cocaine, worth perhaps $125, receive a mandatory minimum of 5 years in prison. However, it takes 500 grams of the powdered drug, nearly $50,000 worth of yuppie cocaine, to receive an equivalent sentence. Consequently, someone caught in a drug bust with a relative small amount of cocaine can receive a sentence that is 2 to 3 years longer than a person convicted of selling nearly 100 times that amount. A few illustrations of this new Kafka-esque class justice. In South Central LA, a young black 3-time loser, never charged with violent crime but holding a weapon, was sentenced to life imprisonment without possibility of parole for the possession of 5.5 grams of crack. A 20-year-old Chinese man received 2 life terms, parole in 40 years, for being accessory to the murder of federal agents, even though he was not at the scene, did not know that the murders would occur, and was described by the judge as playing only a minor role. Meanwhile, a 21-year-old Baldwin Park Chicano, high on PCP, who ran into the back of a truck and killed his passenger, was charged with murder because he was a suspected gang member. Finally, an elite LAPD stakeout team that the Times had exposed as a virtual police death squad ambushed 4 young Latinos who had just robbed a McDonald's in Sunland with a pellet gun. 3 of the Latinos were killed by the cops, while the 4th, seriously wounded, was charged with murder for the deaths of his companions. Processed by such justice, which since 1974 has arrested 2/3 of all younger black males in California, a flood of captives, 4/5 of whom are substance addicted and less than half of whom have committed violent crimes, overwhelm the state prisons. 84,000 inmates in a system with room for 48,000. With the prison population expected to continue to soar as a result of the victories of the war on drugs and gangs to 145,000 by 1995, California is creating a time bomb of multiple Attica potential. Lacking minimal educational, job training, or drug treatment resources, the prisons of today have all but abandoned the pretense of rehabilitation. Some are merely minimum security warehouses where the inmate populations are turned over to endless television game show viewing. Others, especially designed to accommodate the hardcore gangsters from Los Angeles's ghettos and barrios, are Orwellian hells. The ultimate destination for a damned generation is an Antarctica of solitude moored to the picturesque Redwood Coast, just south of the Oregon border. The prison's name, Pelican Bay, evokes a nature reserve or peaceful sanctuary, but this is only a cruel joke in face of the incredible social isolation and sensory deprivation contained inside. As journalist Miles Corwin describes it, Pelican Bay is entirely automated and designed so that inmates have virtually no face-to-face contact with guards or other inmates. For 22 and a half hours a day, inmates are confined to their windowless cells, built of solid blocks of concrete and stainless steel, so that they won't have access to materials they could fashion into weapons. They don't work in prison industries. They don't have access to recreation. They don't mingle with other inmates. They aren't allowed to smoke, because matches are considered a security risk. The justification for this kind of isolation, unprecedented in modern prisons, according to one authority whom Corwin interviewed, is simply that these inmates are the worst of the worst. As a prison officer elaborates, prisons are representative of what's going on in the streets. You've got more gangs and violence on the streets, so you've got more gangs and violence in the prisons. You need a place to put these people. That's why a place like Pelican Bay is necessary. The Blacklash. We have to learn to fight black oppression as much as we fight white oppression. Earl Caldwell. I challenge you because I love you. Jesse Jackson. As the high-tech gulag of Pelican Bay suggests, the specter of the black criminal underclass has begun to augment, even replace, the red menace, as the satanic other which justifies the trampling of civil liberties. George Bush's notorious 1988 Willie Horton television spot, which destroyed Michael Dukakis's commanding lead, has terrified a whole generation of Democrats into believing that their political survival depends on being even more bloodthirsty than Republicans. For instance, witness the role of Death Row in California's 1990 gubernatorial campaign. In California, Hahn, Reiner, and Vandekamp are exemplars of younger Democrats trying to ride the gibbet, or more literally the gas chamber, to higher office. Moreover, as we noted earlier, there has been little effective opposition from their left. In a 1988 interview, Joan Howarth of the ACLU complained more in sadness than bitterness that progressives have virtually deserted us on this issue. The left has been largely shut out of the policy debate, which is now totally framed by the Reaganite right and its Democratic shadow. There is no progressive agenda on crime, and consequently no challenging of the socioeconomic forces that have produced the burgeoning counterculture of gang membership. The LAPD likes to rub the ACLU's face in the new post-liberal balance of power. In June 1988, the police easily won police commission approval for the issuing of flesh-ripping hollow-point ammunition, precisely the same dum-dum bullets banned in warfare by the Geneva Conventions and previously kept out of their hands by ACLU lobbying. At the press conference, a gloating LAPD spokesperson told the civil libertarians to eat your hearts out. In philosophically justifying the hammer, step, and other encroachments on the Constitution, the gangbusters have had to look no further than Moynihanized recapitulations of traditional white prejudice. Family failure in the ghetto, abetted by indulgent welfarism, the decline of paternal role models in the flight of the black middle class, have connived to create a feral population of grave social menace. Thus, once and future mayoral challenger Yaroslavsky, in his student days McGovern's UCLA organizer, snarls when asked about the economic roots of the gang problem and tells a nasty little story of doubtful accuracy about a drunken welfare mother in the ghetto abusing police for arresting her gang member son. As head of the council committee overseeing the police budget, Yaroslavsky has made it clear that gang busting deserves a blank check. In a city where emergency medical care for the poor is virtually collapsed, where 100,000 sleep without beds, and where infant mortality levels are inching upwards toward third world levels, Yaroslavsky has put police firepower above all. A budget is a statement of priorities, and if fighting gang violence in this city is our highest priority, it should be reflected in our budget, and it will be at the expense of virtually anything else. In past years, this pitiless approach to juvenile crime might simply have been dismissed as the venom of white backlash, racism in its law and order guise. But this time, there is an unprecedented blacklash as well. The qualitatively new and disturbing dimension of the war on the underclass is the swelling support of black leadership for the approaches of Gates, Hahn, and Reiner. Thus, the NAACP endorsed Hahn's attempt to impose martial law on the Playboy gangsters, while the influential South Central Organizing Committee, SCOC, the church-supported local affiliate of the Industrial Areas Foundation, IAF, has been a major voice calling for greater police deployment against street youth. Even Maxine Waters, a respected legislator from Watts Willowbrook and co-chair of the California Rainbow Coalition, has reluctantly endorsed police sweeps and street terrorism laws. The trend is national. Although Jesse Jackson continues to campaign for the rescue of ghetto youth, including hardcore gang members, others argue that vigilantism has become the order of the day. In an essay written from Oakland Ground Zero, the novelist Ishmael Reed predicts that the time is fast approaching when the black working class, people who've put in time at stupid, dull jobs all their lives and suffered all manner of degradation so that their children might become achievers, will have to take the offensive against black terrorists, the brutal crack fascists. Comparing daily existence in East Oakland or Watts to the oppression in Haiti under the Tonton Macoute, Reed scorns white liberals from the hills who have out of Nicaragua bumper stickers on their Volvos but are perfectly willing to tolerate drug fascists who prey upon the decent citizens of Oakland. In order to save black America, Reed canvasses the idea of a curfew for 18 to 24-year-olds and a much sterner community invigilation of youth. But Harry Edwards, organizer of the famous Black Power protests at the 1968 Olympics and former minister of propaganda for the Black Panther Party, doubts the efficacy of anything short of the permanent removal of a large stratum of youth from the streets. Now a professor of sociology at UC Berkeley and a highly paid consultant to professional sports, Edwards gave a chilling account of his views to an interviewer from a San Francisco magazine. When asked how he would turn around a 13-year-old kid selling crack in the streets, he replied, "Edwards, the reality is you can't." San Francisco Focus, "So then what?" Edwards, "You gotta realize that they're not gonna make it. The cities, the culture, and black people in particular have to begin to move to get that garbage off the streets." San Francisco Focus, "How?" Edwards, "It means we have to realize that there are criminals among us, and we have to take a very hard line against them if we are to preserve our next generation and future generations, even if they are our children." San Francisco Focus, "So what do you do if you're a parent and you discover your 13-year-old kid is dealing crack?" Edwards, "Turn him in, lock him up, get rid of him. Lock him up for a long time, as long as the law will allow, and try to make it as long as possible. I'm for locking him up, getting him off the streets, put him behind bars." Black middle-class revulsion against youth criminality, indeed the perception that dealers and gangs threaten the very integrity of black culture, is thus translated through such patriarchal bluster into support for the exterminist rhetoric of the gangbusters. It is a dismal sign of the times that once fiery nationalist intellectuals like Reed and Edwards can openly float the idea that a sacrifice or triage of criminalized ghetto youth, i.e., the garbage, is the only alternative to the dissolution of a community fabric heroically built up over generations of resistance to racist white America. How is it that intergenerational relations within the black community have suddenly grown so grimly foreboding?